listening to CITR 101.9. This is CITR News Live, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Arman Rana. It's Monday, the 19th of October at around 5.03 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamin-speaking Musqueam people. So we were supposed to have a conversation with folks discussing the situation in Iran and Afghanistan. However, that interview got rescheduled. So instead, I'm going to be playing a recorded episode of an interview I did with Globe and Mail journalist Kerry Gold on real estate and whistleblower protection and kind of whistleblower investigation gone wrong. It was actually like really old. It's like 3 months before the start of COVID. So basically it was December 20th, 2019. So 3 years ago to the day almost. And ironically, I'd placed this episode in a folder called Evergreen and kind of forgot about it due to COVID, and I kind of left it in the station. I didn't really look at what I had. So we're kind of going to test the limits of how evergreen this episode really is today. And surprisingly, little has changed in Vancouver's housing market and the whole housing situation. The one thing I did notice, and that you'll also notice during this interview, is the focus has shifted a bit and the conversation has shifted a bit from toxic demand to nowadays we talk a lot more about supply. So yeah, here's the interview with Kerry Gold.
So could you start off by introducing yourself?
Well, I've been a journalist for at least 25 years. I started out at the Vancouver Courier, and then I went to the Vancouver Sun for 10 years. I was a music critic, and then I went to I became a freelance writer, and I work for the Globe and Mail, writing a column every week for about housing issues and real estate. I've been doing that for 12 years, and I also, I write magazine pieces, and I also write books. Housing has become a major part of my beat.
Yeah, so I was listening to your an interview that you did a number of years ago where you described Vancouver as the epicenter of weirdness when it comes to real estate. So how did Vancouver become the epicenter of weirdness? How did it become so weird?
Oh, it's a really good question, because we are a freak show. And we're either a freak show, or you could call us the Wild West. Because what happened to Vancouver, I think, is because we were so largely unregulated for so long. And also there was a fair bit of denial going on for many, many, many years. And I was one of the first, maybe even the first, I'm not sure, to address the problem of rising home prices, like escalating beyond anything that was remotely normal, and the fact that incomes were not rising. So you had a fairly low-income city where housing was suddenly, you know, if you wanted to buy a detached house, you were looking at $2 million, $3 million. That made no sense. It's not like our incomes were pushing those prices upward. So something else was going on. And because government generally ignored it and refused to even acknowledge it, I blame the policies that were failed to be established, that simply didn't come in to effect to address the problem, as escalating the problem and getting us to the point where we are today, which is in a severe housing affordability crisis.
So in the last few years, the provincial, towards the end of the Christie Clark years and the under this new government, or not new, so new anymore, the provincial and municipal government here have implemented three taxes concerning real estate: the foreign buyers transaction tax, the municipal vacancy tax, and then the provincial speculation and vacancy tax. How effective, if at all, do you perceive these taxes as being in curbing the weirdness or addressing the weirdness?
Yeah, there's also the school tax, if you wanted to throw that in there, because that's
on high value.
Yeah, anything over $3 million. I think it had a huge impact. I mean, I know that real estate prices were already starting to decline before the new provincial government brought in those measures, but the fact that the market continued to soften, and it definitely threw a cold towel on the whole thing, you know, has resulted in a market that really has come down, especially in the high end. If you look at the west side of the city, if you look at West Vancouver, prices for those detached homes there have really plummeted. And those markets were very much targeted by speculation and offshore buying. And we have to acknowledge that a lot of the money, a lot of local incomes were competing with foreign money. And the fact that finally government did acknowledge that, not just at the provincial level, but finally even at the federal level, it is finally starting to change everything. But those tax measures, you know, even the psychology, when you introduce something like that, it dampens, you know, the speculation that was going on. It kind of changes things. I think there's been an adjustment, but I think, I do think that there's been there is a correlation between the current market and those measures being brought in, for sure. And I think most people would agree with that.
So, you know, specifically in terms of, because there's these different taxes, as you mentioned, there's that the school tax for high value homes. Then you also have this, you know, foreign buyers transaction, which is a transaction tax, but you also have a vacancy tax. How do you see these? Do you see these as addressing different things, or are they all just different measures to get at the same sort of behavior that we don't want in the system or something?
Yeah, I think that some are going to be more effective than others. The school tax, which is called a school tax, but apparently the money collected doesn't necessarily go into schools. It kind of goes into general revenues. So that's a very controversial tax. It's also considered kind of a dead-end tax because it's just, you know, it's a wealth tax, mansion tax. It's just taking money because somebody has an expensive home. I think the really interesting one, the real game changer, is the speculation and vacancy tax, which is provincial. And that's a game changer because it's a huge collection of information that we never had before. And if you think about the excuses that government gave for so long, the previous government, it was all because we didn't have enough data. Everybody was saying, oh, if we only knew exactly what was going on, we'd do something. Well, they've got the data now on an annual basis every time people have to submit their declarations that their houses are not empty. And when they do that, and this is the provincial version, the city has its own empty house tax version, but the provincial one, you have to show your social insurance number. You also have to say what percentage of your income you're declaring in Canada. So suddenly that gives the government a lot of information about you, and it tells them, you know, for instance, were you declaring a home as your principal residence when in fact it wasn't? You know, because when it's your principal residence, you're exempt from capital gains tax. But if it's not, you're supposed to pay your tax, right? Are you declaring the home buyer's grant when in fact you're not eligible for that? Suddenly they can cross-reference with Canada Revenue Agency, and suddenly they're going to get a bigger picture on who's been dodging their taxes.
So is this this part of the, because there's also the beneficial ownership registry. So does this also, like, because you have, you have, as you said, as part of these vacancy tax, you collect this data, but you also have that's a separate thing where you have this beneficial ownership registry, which is collecting some other data which shows who's the actual owner of the property. So do you see these? Because in your recent article in the Globe and Mail, you have armed with new data, BC set for a crackdown on tax evasion in the Vancouver property market. Do you imagine these kind of working together to kind of get that data?
Yeah, the beneficial ownership one is interesting too, because suddenly you can't hide a property behind a numbered company, which is what a lot of people were doing. The directors have to be disclosed, from what I understand. So that's going to add even more to the picture that is forming. You know, we're going to see patterns. Or, you know, who exactly owns that property that some holding company, some numbered company that doesn't make any sense? I mean, suddenly you'll see the name, you'll see the address, you'll see if they're a local income earner or if they're somebody who lives globally, who's earning their income elsewhere. That is going to play a huge part in establishing this picture. And as I wrote in that piece, I think the one that you're referring to was where I quoted the immigration lawyer Richard Kurland, who's done a ton of work, investigative work on this topic. It could result in audits, you know, because he told me that the CRA has hired some people who speak, you know, a variety of languages. They're gonna learn how to do, you know, more complex offshore audits. They're gonna start going after people who may earn a lot of money somewhere else and own several homes in the Lower Mainland that they might have sold, but they haven't, you know, paid their fair share of taxes on them. Or satellite families, where you have people who are living in Vancouver, but the money is coming from somewhere else, and they're not declaring that income.
Have there been any unintended consequences of all these measures, especially with regards to what you're just talking about, taxes so far, that you've noticed or observed in the property market?
Not so far. I mean, I know that there was some concern about filling out a form every year for some people, that they might not fill it out. You know, maybe if you're older or if you're disabled and what if you don't fill out the form and then are they going to tax you? But I think that was a pretty, in the big picture, pretty minor problem. It's pretty new, right? These things have only come in the last couple of years. And I haven't seen a downside yet. As I said, the school tax is controversial because you could have people who are pensioners living in homes that through no fault of their own have become incredibly expensive, yeah. Right? But they can defer their taxes. But still, whether it's fair that they are, you know, they could see that as punitive, the fact that they're paying suddenly, 2%? I'm trying to remember what the tax is on the school tax on a property.
I think it escalates.
It does. It's 0.2% for homes value between 3 and 4, and I think it's 0.4% on a home that's over 4 million. A lot of people won't have a lot of sympathy for somebody who's sitting in a $4 million home. But yeah, I mean, if your grandma...
Yeah, it's something, right? I think we discussed in a previous interview with Alex Hemingway, is that sometimes your ability to service the tax is a function of your income, and your income could be really low, but the value of your property could be really high. And as you mentioned, like, possibly the way to deal with that is to expand. There are options to defer it, maybe to expand the options to defer it to more people.
Yeah. Well, they're already pretty wide. I mean, to defer taxes, you only have to be over 55 or disabled, or I can't think of the other reasons. But, you know, it's already pretty broad. I think it's pretty easy to defer taxes. I know people who are deferring taxes, you know, and they're like wealthy developer type. I mean, so it is pretty easy. I mean, the thing is, when you die, whoever inherits the property has to pay a big chunk of taxes if they've been deferred for a long time.
And I guess the person who inherits it may not be able to afford to live in that property then.
But yeah, if half of it is going to taxes. Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, I mean, you know, that's why I think the speculation and vacancy tax gets people more excited, because that is directly going after the problem of foreign ownership without paying a fair share of taxes, and also empty homes, you know, just sitting on a property and letting it go up in value and reaping the profits, right? Which is what, you know, a lot of that behavior, that speculative buying on the part of Canadians and non-residents is, you know, from everything I've studied, largely responsible for driving us into an affordability crisis.
And it's interesting.
A lot of bad behavior.
When you talk about that speculation vacancy tax, you kind of pitch in a two-fold way in that it's also providing the data and it's preventing this negative behavior. So it's like a twofer in terms of like why you'd want to do it.
And it still needs to be tweaked. I mean, there is an exemption if you are renting out part of the house. Like, you can shove in a basement suite quickly and suddenly you're exempt, even if you are a non-resident. And I don't think that should be that. The intention wasn't to have, you know, foreign landlords, you know, exempt from this tax. I don't think that was the intention. So it may, you know, that's a nice idea because you have more rentals on the market, but it's still not getting to the root of the problem, which are people who aren't paying their fair share of taxes. So it still needs a bit of tweaking. And I've talked to, like, Josh Gordon, who's an academic at SFU, and he studies policy, and that's one of his criticisms about the tax. So it's not perfect.
The criticism is that if you rent out the basement of your property, you can be exempt for the whole property?
Yeah.
I see. I was wondering, you mentioned, like, how much do you perceive of the speculation is foreign, and how much of it is, wealthy people within Vancouver, within BC, or within Canada, or even within North America, who are just seeing Vancouver as a lucrative, market to park their money for something, or were seeing in the past?
Yeah, it's really hard to know, actually. I mean, we know that there was the immigrant investor program, which was going on for a long time, and we know that the Quebec immigrant investor program continued because the federal version got shut down because it wasn't actually working. And the criticism of that was basically you're purchasing a Canadian passport just by being a rich person. You know, you come to Canada if you have X number of dollars and $800,000 to invest, and you qualify for eventually for a passport. Well, Quebec has its own immigration policy, and it continued the program, and only recently they've put a pause on it. It's paused until, I think, July next year. But through that program, the immigration lawyer I interviewed said that something like 90-95% of those applicants to Quebec were actually making their way to Toronto and Vancouver. And so we do know that a lot of people have been coming to Vancouver and Toronto, people from other countries, particularly China. And and we know that they're not staying in Quebec, which is the deal for that program. You're supposed to stay in Quebec and contribute to the economy and put down roots and create businesses and all that kind of thing. Instead, most people were going elsewhere and, you know, very likely buying real estate and not contributing to the economy and putting down roots, which is what you want when people come to the country. So, you know, are there figures? I don't know of any real solid numbers on the percentage that came from other countries to do that kind of purchasing. I think mostly I could find them for you, but I know that the immigrant investment program was a huge backdoor entry for a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure. So coming back to the regulation, I think in 2016, then Premier Christy Clark ended so-called self-regulation of the real estate industry. It's now 3 years later. What does that look like in practice?
When the realtors were no longer allowed to, when the real estate council was no longer allowed to be self-regulated?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I know that, well, you're not allowed to represent both the buyer and the seller anymore, from what I understand. I don't know that it's, I haven't really. Oh, and the end of shadow flipping. Shadow flipping was a big deal.
So, could you explain how that worked? I know probably a lot of people know what it is, but could you just?
People were selling the contracts. Basically, they were assigning the contract to the sale of the house.
Yeah. So you're saying that you in terms of how the end of self regulation has impacted is that it's kind of ended shadow flipping and it's prevented the real estate agent from representing both the client and the
seller.
The seller.
Yeah,
well, both are clients, well, but being clients to both parties, I guess. Do you perceive the real estate agents in the real estate industry as resenting these changes, or are they happy in some way that they don't have to, you know, put themselves into ethically questionable positions to, you know, earn a living?
Yeah, I think that most of the realtors I interview are quite happy with the changes. I think that, you know, even if you don't represent a buyer and the seller, which seems to be something more common in outside the city, you know, it might be in markets where there aren't as many realtors and it matters more. But, you know, you can have another agent within the same agency represent the seller if you can't represent them, or, you know what I mean, the buyer. I don't think that impacted too many realtors at all. I think they're quite fine with that. And a lot of, I knew realtors too who thought the fact you could double end it was a bad thing. There's one realtor in particular who's also a lawyer who said, you can't do that in law. Why would you be allowed to do that in real estate?
What do you mean by double end it?
You know, if I represent the buyer and the seller, how can I possibly fairly represent these two parties when, you know, they're negotiating? It doesn't make any sense. So that kind of behavior, that was just crazy. That was bananas. And the shadow flipping, which was a story which Kathy Tomlinson broke at the Globe and Mail, that was unbelievable that was going on. I mean, this was something that was allowed in a contract that somebody figured out and turned it to their advantage, and it was totally being exploited. And I think that really needed to be addressed and shut down. And the task force that was created by the government to look at problems like that, they did shut it down, and so that is I think that affected some of the market too. I mean, we still have the problem of money laundering and how it's connected to real estate. But like I said, I think that we're getting more data. I think and there's also a new federal program whose express purpose is to collect data, and it's part of Statistics Canada. And they're looking at housing data, and that's their entire mandate. And that's fantastic, and that's
what's
new.
What's that called? Do you have?
The Canadian Housing Statistics Program, the CHST. I always get the names wrong, but they're doing wonderful work. You know, they just put out a report on incomes, you know, where a lot of the money's coming from. And they found, for instance, that first-time home buyers are, I think the average income is around $60,000 something, but the average renter only has an income of around $40,000 something. And so where are first-time home buyers coming from? You know, it starts to make you ask questions, because you'd think that they're coming from the rental market, but they're making quite a bit more money, even though 60-something is still not a lot. But it makes you wonder, are they getting into the housing market through the bank of mom and dad? Are they, you know, coming from outside the city? You know, so we're getting more information, more clarity.
So you're saying that they have income of $60,000 and they are able to put down a down payment for a house?
Yeah.
So they have some savings for somebody else.
Yeah, they must be.
Or they must have saved from many, many years. And like in my case, I live with my parents. So I think maybe if you live with your parents, then you kind of, you can build up savings on whatever income. But yeah.
Right. So you're not a renter.
Yeah.
So that would make sense.
Yeah. Or
so someone like you might be the first time home buyer.
Yeah, I guess.
The average one.
Yeah. Coming to that question, as I mentioned to you, I'm a software engineer, and I see a lot of multinational tech companies such as Amazon and Microsoft, as well as some American startups expanding their operations in Vancouver due to the relatively low tech labor costs. It's so easy to acquire immigrant visas relative to the United States at this point. And also the fact that we have a Silicon Valley, Seattle time zone. Do you see this influx of tech money and talent as having an impact on the real estate sector right now or in the future?
Yeah, I know that I interviewed Gil Kelly, who's the planning director of the city of Vancouver, and he certainly thinks so, because he used to be the director of planning in San Francisco. And his big worry is that, I mean, he thinks it's great, you know, that we're getting this new, all these new arrivals within the tech industry, which is great. We need it for the economy. We need jobs. Their concern is that we've got to they've got to respond to that with new policies aimed at creating new housing and a lot more rental. I think there is that. We could turn into the new, I mean, it's happening in Seattle right now. Seattle's, the tech scene there has exploded, and, you know, the housing, there is a direct connection between your industry and housing, for sure. And I think that, but unlike Seattle, we don't have the huge amount of rental. Seattle's built a ton of rental over the years. So we are in a bit of a dangerous position, because if we're going to get all these new people coming here to work, we do need the housing. It's very true. My big concern is what that's going to look like. And something that needs to be considered, and Andy Yan has done a ton of really great work on this, is how our current housing is being used. If you look closely at, say, you know, they call it single-family housing. Most single-family housing is not used by single families. The vast majority, I think Andy found that 85%, are used by multiple families, or they're used as student housing, or you get a lot of housing where new immigrant families are living intergenerationally. Like, you know, there'll be mom and dad in a Vancouver special along with kids and their kids. So existing housing, a lot of it is affordable. Like, people have figured out a way to carve up a house and use it affordably. And the concern is that when the city makes policy changes and introduces, you know, four-story rental buildings or six-story rental buildings, that kind of housing is going to be impacted, and we could see displacement. The last thing you want to do is displace your community. And that has been a huge problem in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's happening now in Seattle. So it's a very delicate balance. And this is the huge challenge that the city has to face. And it's not an easy one. But you can't just throw up buildings and add supply without looking at how the current housing is being used. Right? Because you can't, the families who are, say you have a 5 Vancouver specials in a row with, you know, lots of people in them. If you replace those 5 Vancouver specials with a 4-story apartment building, those people living in those, you know, and I say Vancouver special because it's a very useful type of house. It's divided into two. Those people who were living in those homes can't go into the apartments because they're probably, most of them are going to be studios and one bedrooms. Well, grandma and grandpa can't afford $1,600 a month. They're probably going to have to leave the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of displacement that we have to think about.
Yeah, so we're just going to wrap up the real estate component of this interview then. What are the developments in real estate that you think we should be keeping an eye on as you go into 2020 and into the next couple of years?
I think we need to really focus on affordable housing. I mean, it's great to build more housing, but I think we need to really figure out a way to make it affordable. I think co-ops are great. They're, you know, they're generally based on income, and local incomes are not high. We have to really focus on who we're building for instead of just building. I see that, you know, for instance, you can take down like a little bungalow that might have sold for $1.3 million on the east side, but if you replace it with duplexes that each side sells for $1.5 million, is that affordable? Have you just created affordability, or have you just created more housing? I think we really need to focus on the affordability piece, and that probably is going to take better policy from government, and it's not an easy one. I don't have all the answers, but I do think that's the direction we have to go in now.
So you think seeing co-ops and even more focus on affordability?
Yeah, and I do like co-op housing. I think if you look at something like False Creek, you know, the south side of False Creek, that was all built in the 70s. And you must know it. It's that whole area right by Granville Island where it's all those 70s-looking townhouses, and there's some condos, and they're all in the water. And they've got a mix of co-ops and market condos and rentals in there. It's on city-owned land. And it's because it was created in the 70s, and because there's so much co-op housing in there, and it is leasehold land. It's not, it's owned by the city, but you, if you buy a condo, you are basically buying the lease for X number of years. Well, there's a whole mix of incomes and a whole diversity of people in there, you know, old and young, you know, and it works really well. And it's actually studied throughout the world as a very successful neighborhood. And if we look at that kind of model, I know it's really hard to do in today's political climate. I mean, back in the 70s, things were different. That was old industrial land that got developed. Vancouver's very different. Land values are so high. But I think we need to think more about that, about creating housing forms that are attached to incomes. Because for so long, our housing and our incomes became decoupled. There's been no relationship. We have to bring it back together somehow.
Yeah. And that kind of leads to kind of the flip side is, you know, especially with the way I see it, is also this tech industry thing is a kind of an attempt to increase incomes because it helps the economy. At the same time, it's not necessarily increasing the incomes of the people. There are a subset of people like me who are, you know, who are residents here and then their incomes are going up. But it's also replacing the people here who had lower incomes with high income individuals. Mm-hmm. Who can afford to live here. So I also find that, you know, dynamic kind of interesting.
And you know what we call that? Gentrification.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Welcome back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, if you're just tuning in. I'm Armand Rana, and this is CITR News. You are hearing an interview with real estate journalist, Global Main journalist, Kerry Gold, from December of 2019, almost 3 years ago to the day. And yeah, stay tuned, as because after this quick ad break, we will be playing part two of that interview about a somewhat tragic case, but an important story where whistleblowing kind of went wrong and just the process by which it was handled by the British Columbia government was kind of awful. And yeah, she did some great reporting in Walrus about it. So do stay tuned after the ad break for that.
MRG Live presents The Jinx and Della Holiday Show. Live at the Vogue Theater on December 30th. Another holiday season brings another year of fabulous spectacle. Whip-smart comedy, brand new songs, and annual favorites live and in person from your favorite RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. Join Jinx Monsoon and Ben de la Creme at the Vogue Theater on December 30th. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya.
about 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
Christmas is coming early with 24 hours of student power. Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM on Wednesday, December 7th for 24 hours of pure student radio, featuring special episodes from the Intersectionality Collective, Black Student Union, Astro Jazz, Unseated Airwaves, and Dog-Eared After Dark. Tune in on December 7th so you don't miss out on what all the cool kids are talking about.
So you wrote an article a number of months ago in The Walrus entitled "The Whistleblower Who Got It Wrong," and I actually read it soon after it came out, and I found it really disturbing. I didn't know of the story. I know there was a lot of other reporting as well. I found it later, but when I just read that, it really kind of freaked me out. So, and it documents the story of several researchers who were incorrectly fired by the provincial government under unsubstantiated accusations of, I think, some nepotism and violating medical data privacy and conflicts of interest. And one of the researchers, Roderick McIsaac, eventually tragically took his own life. So could you give our listeners a bit more background about the context that enabled these researchers to get fired?
Yeah, these were just, a group of people. Most of them were long-term employees, for government employees, civil servants just doing their jobs for, 30 odd years, nearing retirement. Roderick was a PhD student, a co-op student. I think he was just there for 1 year when that happened. And he and the others, a group of seven, there were seven people involved, they got drawn into this investigation that was conducted in the provincial government, the Ministry of Health. And and it was the most shockingly inept investigation you could imagine. The people conducting it were incredibly biased in their, they went into it not with an open mind as you're supposed to, but convinced that everyone was guilty. They didn't have any real evidence of any wrongdoing. A lot of it was just emails that they had sifted through. We spent a lot of time sifting through and, making assumptions on emails that sounded like somebody had done something wrong, had accepted money or whatever. But when in fact, as it came out eventually, it took forever to come out, the truth to come out, they hadn't done anything wrong. There might have been a few missteps in procedure, but certainly nothing that would have warranted the reaction by those government investigators or the press conference that was held by the new Minister of Health saying that there was an RCMP investigation, which there wasn't. There never was an investigation by the RCMP. The file that they had turned over to the RCMP was not complete or conclusive enough for them to do any kind of investigation, from what I understand. So, there was, for some bizarre reason, the government felt the need to say that there was an RCMP investigation underway on a group of Ministry of Health employees. And Victoria is a small town. People figured out pretty quickly who they were. And you can imagine, your employer holding a press conference and saying that you're being investigated, and it's on the front page of the Vancouver Sun. So somebody had also leaked the information to the Vancouver Sun the same day that the press conference was held. And pretty quickly everyone figures out who's involved. that would be devastating, because people would just assume, and they did assume, that they had done something really, really wrong, that they had misused public health records. And in a small town like Victoria, you know, these guys were just traumatized, and there was one woman involved too. And Roderick was so traumatized that tragically he took his life. And you can't fix that. That no amount of compensation ever fixes that kind of damage. And they only got the lawsuits and the union action that was taken. It only they only got awarded compensation this year, this past year, and just before my story came out, I believe. And so that took years, because, you know, this whole thing went back to 2012.
Yeah. So you describe several researchers who viewed these firings as politically motivated. There was an argument that, you know, these drug manufacturers donated close to $600,000 to the BC Liberals, and at that time corporate donations were legal. Is there a clear rationale as to why these drug manufacturers would want these researchers fired, or is that?
There, you know, I went into it thinking that there'd be I'd be able to draw a line between the two. It wasn't so easy. It became a case of perhaps because the government, the Liberals, got a lot of funding from pharmaceuticals. There was this belief, this assumption and I should explain that the people who were fired, several of them were working on research that looked at at how drugs worked and whether they were worth the money, if they were, you know, maybe causing health problems. And they did find that some drugs were doing more harm than good, for example. And so because they were doing that kind of research, and this is pretty, you know, really useful, publicly valuable research that is, you know, around the world, you know, everyone benefits. Because they were doing that kind of research, there was this conspiracy theory that perhaps, you know, the government wanted to shut it down on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry. That certainly was never proven. So there was no evidence of that. It seems to be that more likely that this group of people, or rather the people who do that kind of research, you know, maybe they weren't regarded enough. Maybe they weren't given enough credit or appreciated enough. But I think this came down to more just serious incompetence when it came to handling a complaint from a whistleblower and not having a clue how to deal with that complaint and how to truly conduct an investigation on it of employees. And it's just baffling that what happened to them could happen. You know?
So the Public Interest and Disclosures Act came into effect earlier this month. I believe it creates an internal process for whistleblowers in the government to take up allegations of serious violations of the law and have those allegations investigated. So it kind of protects whistleblowers in a way. But this is also a story about a whistleblower who made a mistake.
Yeah.
So do you think such a process could prevent such misfirings from happening again?
I think, now from what I understand of the legislation, is that it doesn't just protect whistleblowers, but I think it also is requiring that investigations are conducted properly and that they're conducted fairly. So I think whistleblowers do need to be protected, but I think the missing part here has been that the investigations were seriously flawed. And so the fact that this legislation is going to, you know, try to remedy that or try to establish a proper system of, you know, procedures or protocol, whatever, I think that is what's key with this legislation. I think that needed to be done. And that was in direct response to this disastrous situation, which was the subject of a huge report called Misfire that came out, and if it's a lot of reading, it's like more than 300 pages or something, but one of the recommendations was definitely, there were many recommendations, but, you know, addressing the investigation and the flawed procedure that had to be done. And I think that's what's key with this legislation.
So last question. You're a journalist yourself, and this law does not offer protections for employees to go to the media, I believe. So do you think that would be helpful? And have you had personal experiences dealing with whistleblowers? And like, what are your thoughts? And then how do you handle them? Do you have a process for that?
I actually do occasionally get emails from people who are whistleblowers. I just got one the other day, actually. I think that you can, I mean, media, you don't reveal a source anyway. I mean, you wouldn't be a very good reporter if you did do that. I didn't actually realize that there's no protection for, so you're saying for government employees, there's no protection for them if they go to the media?
I believe, well, there was this blog post, I should remember the name. I could send it to you later, where it was a Canadian, it's a Vancouver-based journalist who's criticizing this law for not offering protections for government employees who go to the media, but only if they follow this internal process.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I actually didn't know about that, but I mean, I think they should be protected. Maybe, I can't imagine why they wouldn't be, but maybe they prefer that you go to your employer before you go running to the media.
Exactly.
And embarrassing everybody. I guess that's to be expected, but, you know, as a reporter, I welcome whistleblowers. I mean, look what's happening in the U.S. right now. That was all because of a whistleblower. And, you know, and somebody must have reported something to the media, because obviously that wasn't going to get out too easily. But anyway, yeah, no, whistleblowing is important. It's a huge part of our system. And so, too, is protecting people who are being investigated, because to be on the receiving end of an investigation is hugely stressful. And the people who were wrongly accused in this case, you know, a lot of them are still suffering from severe depression and even post-traumatic stress disorder in at least one case. And going back to work has been hard. Some of them haven't returned yet. And, of course, one man killed himself. So this has been a really traumatic situation. Having your employer accuse you of things like that, and to do it publicly, it definitely was one of the worst examples in Canada. And I think this legislation wants to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. It's about 5:51 on the 19th of December. You just heard part two of an interview I conducted almost 3 years ago to the date, 20th December 2019, with journalist Kerry Gold. This was before COVID, 3 months before COVID. This was before Trump was still president at the time. It's kind of crazy to think about. She was making some references to Trump being president with the whistleblowing. Really talking about, you know, what happened with a case where whistleblowing went wrong in the BC government. Kerry Gold wrote an article. The title of that article is, I think, Whistleblower Protection When Whistleblowing Goes Wrong, I believe it's called. It's now 3 years old, but I think it still holds up pretty well. And yeah, I had this kind of little clip of just, kind of shows how much has changed, but how little has changed. You know, I was referencing that I was going to air this podcast. I was intending to air it 3 months from, you know, 2019 December, and I made a bit of a prediction and about what's happening in Vancouver. Take a quick listen to that. Interviews for two different episodes at some point next year, because these are kind of evergreen topics, right? Especially real estate in Vancouver. I don't think something's going to change like
a month from now, and suddenly, like, everything's super cheap. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, everything's been fixed.
Like,
yeah. So, yeah, 3 months from now, of course, COVID happened, and the real estate market did dip a bit for very briefly, but so much changed, but so much has stayed the same. And yeah, well, that's about it for today's show. Next time, we're going to be probably next week, Thursday, we're going to be speaking to some folks about the situation in Afghanistan and Iran. They were involved in leading some of the marches that we saw earlier this year in Vancouver. So super important story there. The music you heard at the beginning of today's show was Song of the Meese by Sarah Pratt. You can listen to more of her on SoundCloud. And in terms of CIT News, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And of course, the RSS feed is available on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. So check us out there.